This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
This is Decoder, helping you make sense of the new world of media. That phrase, the new world of media, it's certainly no exaggeration. The media world is always new, always changing. So this episode, we focus on how journalists fit in to the changing media. Coming up, we'll look at a case of a blogger and his run-in with a publication ban. And from bloggers to robots. Yes, should I be watching my back for the next robot reporter? But first, we'll hear about reality TV. Is it real? And more importantly, is it journalism? I'm your host, Julianne Hazelwood, and you're listening to Decoder. When it comes to reality TV, producers cast their characters and put them in predetermined, constructed environments. And then they edit the tape to tell a certain story. Wait, am I talking about reality TV? Or am I talking about journalism? Is there a fine line between the two? Well, Anna Delaney set out for some answers.
Reality TV. Survivor. American Idol.
This is American Idol.
We all know it's a little bit constructed, but how much reality is really there? Does the media construct all aspects of the show? The characters' personalities, the plot lines, the script? And how does all this relate to journalism? Well, I spoke to Kit Redmond from RTR Media. She is a CBC journalist turned reality TV producer who has worked for the Women's Network and the Discovery Channel. She was also the executive producer of Instant Beauty Pageant.
Break free from the boring beauty pageant mold. Watch these girls shop till they drop and do their stuff to win a title and a dazzling tiara. Find out who's going to be the next Miss Instant Beauty.
While some might think that journalism and reality TV are worlds apart, Kit sees things a little differently.
One of the first reality shows was Real World. And Real World came from a partnership between Jonathan Murray and his wife. She had worked in soap operas and he had been a journalist. And you put the two together and you got reality TV.
Lauren O'Neill is another journalist with experience with reality TV. She is a fellow Decoder reporter and she was on an episode of Instant Beauty Pageant produced by Kit. The show challenges shoppers to compete in a beauty pageant in a matter of hours. And although it seems like all fun and games, Lauren says that the show constructed her to be someone else.
I remember being upset because there was another girl who was at my university. She was in the same year as me, same level, and they kept calling her a math genius, and they kept referring to the fact that she was a fourth-year university student, and they didn't even mention the fact that I was in university once.
Tanya Thongs had a similar experience to Lauren. She was on season 2 of The Lofters.
Cameras everywhere.
This is our reality.
On The Lofters, a group of strangers lived together in downtown Toronto while cameras watched their every move. Tanya says her producers made the cast into characters to fulfill certain plots. This was especially true for her and her castmate Danny.
You fit into these categories, right? I was the token black girl, you know? Danny was the pretty boy, so it didn't matter what his personality was like, you know? So you have to have a bunch of girls to come over all the time in the loft, and you have to talk about your sexual experiences, and that's what they portrayed him to be. Meanwhile, he had a girlfriend when he got into the show.
Oh.
You know, and he lost her because she watched the show.
Not only did Tanya fit into a role for the show, she was also told to recreate crucial life moments so the camera could catch the drama.
They knew that I was bisexual. They wanted me to come out to my mother. And when I spoke to my mother, they did not record the call. So they wanted me to call her back and do it again so that they can film it. It was so stupid, you know? My mother already knew.
Lauren agrees with Tanya. Her afternoon in the mall was actually a 14-hour day, filled with reenactments and line coaching.
you know, you'd be sitting there with the director in front of you and they'd say something like, "So, what do you think of this contestant?" And you'd be like, you know, she seems nice. Oh, well, do you think that she's a better competitor than you are? And I'd be like, well, no. Okay, so can you just say that in a sentence form? Say, I don't think that Izzy is a better competitor than me. So you'd be like, okay, sure. I don't think that Izzy is a better competitor than me. And, you know, and then it comes across as catty, even though you didn't mean it to be that way.
Okay, so maybe this isn't something new. Reality TV has become known for being a little less than real. But is there any truth to this so-called reality? And what about the journalism connection? Journalists pick characters and write a script and edit clips to tell a story. So Kit says her journalism training helps her keep the real in reality TV.
Having a journalism training is really a good background. I wish more people had it.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you haven't got that rigorous training behind you, people are much more likely to play loosey-goosey with the facts.
While Lauren agrees that Kit relies on facts, she's a bit weary about calling the show accurate.
She did rely on facts, but they're carefully selected facts. She chose us for a reason, because she knew that we were the types to go out there and play and be performers. She knows that we both have dramatic arts and theater backgrounds, and I think that they pick these certain people. And sure, the facts that they told were true. Jacqueline and I were best friends. Yes, we do love to shop. Yes, I have blonde hair, and sometimes I like to dance around like an idiot. But there are a lot more things that comprise Lauren O'Neill, and none of that was shown.
Despite Lauren's feelings, Kit still sees a connection between reality TV and journalism. In fact, she's quick to point out that the original definition of reality TV was news footage. And the fact is, people want to watch. It's the connection viewers feel with reality TV stars that keeps them engaged.
In those constructed reality shows, I think you are exploring truth. You may not be exploring real, but you may be exploring truth. And I think a lot of the reason why those shows are very, very successful is that they reveal human character and human nature. You connect through story when the story is about the viewer. Or if you think of a petal going into a pond and the circles coming out, it's about them. It's about their family. The next circle is about their community, their city, their country, their world. And the further you remove yourself, the less likely they are to watch that story.
So what do aspiring journalists think of the proposed connection? Well, I've assembled some of my classmates to find out. Here with me now are Jess Brady, James Jackson, and Steve Howard. Thanks for coming in, guys.
Happy to be here.
No problem.
Thanks.
So what do you think of this? Have you ever thought about a connection between reality TV and journalism before?
Never. I never put the two in the same sentence. I don't watch TV, let alone reality TV, so I would be insulted by comparing them.
Does anyone agree with James?
You know, I kind of do, because I had never thought of it as like as two comparable items before either. But once I did start to think about it, you know, I could sort of see maybe some of the similarities and why people might think that. I personally don't, but maybe I could see why other people might.
Right. What do you think, Steve?
I'd never thought about it before. I think there are some superficial similarities. There's definitely the idea that you're trying to get people watching the show, and you're trying to tell a story to a certain extent, which is what you're doing in journalism. But I don't think that's any different from journalism, comparing journalism to anything else that's really on TV. It's no matter what's out there, you're trying to get people to watch it, and you're trying to tell stories.
Okay, well, I spoke to Tanya Thongs, as you heard. She was on The Lofters, and she worked as a journalist before and after the show. This is what Tanya had to say about her connection with journalism and reality TV.
You know, as a journalist, my job was also to create something that's going to get the viewers to stay watching.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to write, you have to edit, you have to approve it, you have to come up with the concept, you have to find people to interview that you think are going to be well-spoken on camera.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like this is all things that you're doing naturally while what they're doing to you while you're on this show.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then we're also doing it as a job.
So I think it's really interesting what she said there. You know, what producers do to the people on the reality TV show, we as journalists do to some of the people that we interview. And I think a really good point that she pointed out that maybe not a lot of people think about is that if you're interviewing someone for TV, you have to think about if they're going to be comfortable and if they're going to be well-spoken and articulate. Same for radio. So What do you guys make of her comments there?
Well, I think there's a certain amount of truth to what she said, but I think there are different reasons for looking at the suitability of the person. Like, for reality TV, you're looking for entertainment value. Is this person going to make the audience laugh? Whereas for journalists, I think the biggest concern for us is how we get the story across. So if you have someone who is uncomfortable on camera or on air, they're not going to serve the story. They're not going to be able to engage people to let them know what the importance is. For us, when we're trying to find a character to bring that story across, it's all about the importance of the story and what the truth is. And for reality TV, that's just about entertainment.
But at the same time, though, I think she's right in that you are looking for people who are ultimately going to be entertaining. Like, you don't want someone, especially on TV or radio, who's just kind of has no personality whatsoever, whether they tell the story accurately or not. You want someone who's ultimately going to entertain people. So I think she's right that there are similarities, and maybe that's something we should think about more as journalists, is what kind of people, the reasons we're actually putting people on the air.
Yeah, Steve, that's a good point. I think as journalists, we have to find a balance between entertaining and informing, and that can be a challenge sometimes. So thanks a lot, guys. You've raised some really great points, and I really appreciate you coming in. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Anytime.
You're listening to Decoder, helping you make sense of the new world of media.
She was last seen Friday evening in Highfield Square Mall in Moncton, New Brunswick.
The woman has been reunited with her family after a month-long ordeal.
Romeo Jacques Cormier enters Moncton Court, charged with kidnapping, unlawful confinement, robbery, assault.
Police have laid a host of charges, including sexual assault against the suspect. And because of these sexual assault allegations, a court has ruled that we can no longer identify the victim.
You were just listening to some news clips on a story about a Moncton grandmother who was missing for nearly a month. But as you heard from the clips, a publication ban went into effect after the woman came home in order to keep her name out of the media. So this case raises some really important issues when it comes to court-ordered publication bans in an age of the blogosphere and social media. So our reporter Joel Tiller is here to tell us more about that. Thanks for joining me here in the studio today, Joel.
Thank you, Julianne.
So publication bans is something that at least traditional media is pretty used to dealing with.
Yeah, I mean, for newspapers, TV, and radio stations, publication bans are nothing new. Most have a team of lawyers on their side to prevent them from publishing something that may defy the ban. But this, of course, isn't the case for bloggers and people who use social media tools like Twitter and Facebook.
Okay.
And this raises the questions of whether bloggers and social media users are expected to adhere to publication bans. And if they are, what are the repercussions for violating the ban?
Okay, so why don't you start off by telling us some more specifics on this case, because this is a pretty unique case.
Well, you're right. This case is unique in that for almost an entire month, the missing woman's name and picture were everywhere. She appeared on local and national news broadcasts, in papers, blogs, and Twitter and Facebook feeds, but all of that came to a halt after she returned home. New developments in her disappearance began to surface, and it was learned that she was the victim of an alleged sexual assault.
And that's where the publication ban would come in.
Exactly. And as soon as her abductor, a man by the name of Romeo Jacques Cormier, was formally charged with a number of crimes, including sexual assault, the court immediately issued a publication ban.
So even though her name was everywhere for the month she was missing, it would be a breach of the publication ban if her name was mentioned alongside her abductor's name.
You're right, and exactly that scenario happened about 2 hours after the publication ban kicked in. A lot of people in the blogosphere were unaware of the ban, including Brian Cormier.
Okay, is that any relation to the abductor?
I don't think so, no. Brian is an active blogger and self-proclaimed social media expert. He's also been a part-time reporter for the Moncton Times and Transcript for over 30 years. But with all of his experience, reporting this story had even this veteran a little confused.
What I did, I went on Twitter and I mentioned her name and I believe his name in the same sentence or something like that. And a CBC journalist contacted me and said, you should know that you broke the publication ban because you connected her to the charges of sexual assault. It's very rare that a very high profile case becomes the subject of a publication ban because literally everyone knew who this person was.
Ah, so what happened when Brian got that email that he was in breach of the ban?
Well, Julianne, that was one of the first things I asked Brian, and here's what he had to say.
When I got the email, I was very concerned. First of all, I didn't want to break the law. Second of all, although I'm not a full-time journalist with a newspaper, I do write a column and certainly aspire to ethical journalistic standards and didn't want to hurt this woman any more than she already had been. So that was my reaction, basically. I took it down right away. It was an extra safe thing, and I'm not even sure that I did break the publication ban, to be quite honestly, but just to be safe, I took down that post.
Okay, so he deleted the post, but he doesn't feel as though he violated the ban.
You know what? That really stuck out for me, too, when I was talking to him. So I asked him why he was inclined to say that he didn't feel as though he was in breach of the ban.
I'd have to go back to, I didn't know you were going to ask that question, so I'm going to have to, I have to go back to, well, I deleted it now. So I can't remember. I did delete it. I mentioned her name, okay, and that there was someone who was charged. So I think a lot of people meant, probably misunderstood at the beginning of the publication ban that you couldn't mention her name at all, but it was only in relation to the sexual assault charge.
That was Brian Cormier, blogger and part-time journalist for the Moncton Times and Transcript, and despite his justification, Julianne, he isn't alone in saying that he wasn't in direct violation of the ban. Tim Curry is an online journalism instructor at King's College in Halifax, and when the CBC learned of Brian's little mishap and subsequently ran a short piece on bloggers adhering to publication bans, Tim came to both his and the blogosphere's defense.
I mean, I don't want to provide a value judgment, but I think Brian Cormier wasn't aware of it, when he made that. So, I mean, people are just going about their normal lives and talking about things they're interested in. So, I mean, I think, it's fair to say that what's happening today is people aren't distinguishing between publishing as we knew it 10, 15 years ago and publishing today. Most people are just talking to their friends on Facebook, sharing things they're interested in, and, that's publishing today if you're on Facebook, if you're on Twitter. So I don't think people make the distinction.
That was Tim Curry, an online journalism instructor at King's College in Halifax.
So, Joel, if people are really going about their daily lives, as Tim just said, and, writing whatever they may on their blog or Facebook page, could that be considered a violation of a person's privacy?
You see, this is where it gets a little tricky. As I'm sure you know, online content is more or less set in stone. It's not going anywhere, and the implications of something written or said could last a lifetime. So I asked him, could defying a publication ban, even if inadvertently, jeopardize one's right to privacy?
I wouldn't say in jeopardy. In the United States, publication bans are fairly rare, and, I don't think many people there would think they're in jeopardy because people talk about them. Today, most people don't know about the publication ban, for one, when they speak about them. I took a look at on the Moncton case, I took a look online just the morning the publication ban was announced, and there were probably, 10 people on Twitter who would seem to have broken the ban, but only 3 of them seemed to be doing it willingly because they were talking about how they, didn't like the ban and, were mentioning the woman's name in defiance of it. I mean, that's the other thing. You can't take this information back once it's published, right? So it's retweeted, it's forwarded, and it keeps going. So does it jeopardize people's privacy? I would say it's very difficult to keep things private in the internet age.
So listening to Tim just there really makes me think about whether bloggers have the same responsibilities as journalists, with respect to libel and defamation.
Well, to get a legal perspective on all of this, I called Dan Burnett. Dan's a media lawyer in Vancouver and an instructor in media law at the UBC Graduate School of Journalism. He was able to shed some light on how Canadian courts deal with breaching publication bans.
Well, it's interesting. I think they're in a different situation. They certainly, if we're dealing with the responsibility to obey the law, the answer on the whole is yes. But at the same time, there's, I think that courts are going to have to grapple with in this area and in defamation and in privacy law and all sorts of things. You have to grapple with the fact that you've got, in many cases, some well-intentioned person who's trying to, inform people about something important, who fall offside because they haven't got a team of lawyers advising them on every step they take. But it's going to, you know, vary, right? If you've got somebody who's just decided that they don't like the fact that there are publication bans, and so they decide to take the law into their own hands and just thumb their nose at it, the court's going to come down pretty hard.
That was Dan Burnett, a media lawyer from Vancouver.
So Dan was saying that courts are going to come down hard. What does he mean by that?
Well, it depends on a couple of things, really.
In terms of publication ban breaches, there's never been, I think I'm accurate in saying that there's never been a person jailed in Canada over a publication ban breach. It's always a fine situation. And it's going to depend considerably on the impact that the publication had. I mean, there's going to be a basic fine to start with, you know, whether it's $5,000 or $10,000. The court would also look at the financial means of if you've got a blogger who's a university student with no assets, who's just well-intentioned but didn't get it. The court's going to take that into consideration too in terms of a penalty.
So, do you think we should be modeling ourselves after the U.S. when it comes to publication bans? It doesn't really seem like bans are really effective in protecting people's privacy.
Well, Julianne, you are not the only one.
You know, in a very broad sense, I'm convinced that, you know, we're kind of addicted to publication bans, and we're kind of fooling ourselves if we think that they really are the answer to protecting, you know, fair trials and protecting individuals. I'm not saying that there's zero place for them, but for journalists and for a blogger who decides to act in a journalistic sort of capacity, and especially if you start reporting on the courts, it's just a minefield. There's just bans for everything, and the result is that open justice really, really suffers.
So there we are. We're addicted to publication bans, but they are not always the answer.
You know what? Canada's legal system could do with a bit of a makeover. I mean, it's pretty easy to blog or tweet about just about anything. And whether these individuals are intentionally defying publication bans or not, it doesn't really matter because prosecuting them seems next to impossible.
Okay. Well, Joel, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you, Julianne.
You're listening to Decoder, helping you make sense of the new world of media. On this episode of Decoder, we've taken you on a little bit of a journey from the real world of reality television to the blogosphere. Reality television and the blogosphere, they're quite familiar to us. We know what they are whenever we turn on the TV or go online. They're right in front of us. But an area of the changing media we might not be as familiar with is robotics. Perhaps I should be a little more clear. I'm talking about robot journalists. It doesn't have legs or arms, a body or face. It's a scramble of wires and microprocessors on a pair of wheels with a camera atop its roughly 4-foot-tall structure. Meet RoboJournalist. Researchers at Tokyo University created it. Totally autonomous, this robot can detect changes in its surroundings, decide if the changes mean anything, take pictures, question nearby people, do research on the web, and then write a story and post it online. But I think I'll stop there and let RoboJournalist tell you about itself in its own words. This is from an article it wrote.
Newly upgraded robot journalist, improvement from previous versions, including ambient anomaly detection ability for seeking of stories. People will become worried. Robot journalist is overturning professions.
I don't know if journalists actually need to become worried. Do we? The whole thing seems a little unreal.
This is not an April Fool's joke.
I promise you it's not. That was just Ivor Shapiro, a journalism professor at Ryerson University. I did talk with him on April 1st, but of course I wasn't trying to play any joke. This new robo-journalist is the real deal. But I wouldn't say the robot has a lot of real journalistic skill. I mean, did you hear the poor sentence structure from its article? Whew. Now, Ivor has an interesting way of summing journalism up. He divides it into 5 parts: discovery, examination, interpretation, style, and presentation. And he says that a robot journalist could really only do one of these. Maybe us journalists don't need to worry at all.
I guess it can do discovery. Well, actually, it can do a part of discovery. The work of discovery involves coming up with an idea for a story that is based in reality or curiosity. A robot is not capable of intelligent assessment of reality or of curiosity. They are incapable of the other element of discovery, which is to ask questions, to find out facts, to collect data. Robots can collect data. I'll grant them that.
Collecting data, it's part of what journalists do, and it's part of the first component of Ivor's journalism job description. But if a robot can do this same function, maybe that shouldn't be such an important part of journalism.
There is more and more and more information available every day, right? But there was a time when journalists were providers of information. We thought of journalists as gatekeepers of information. There was a ton of information out there, consumers of information, and had no way of getting it. That's no longer true. Journalists should start seeing themselves increasingly as interpreters and stylers of information, and less as gatekeepers of information. And I'm not sure that the culture of our business has yet caught up to that changed reality.
Another reality here is that robo-journalist is not alone. If we look back, a robot by the name of Afghan Explorer was created in 2002. News agencies could use this robot to record footage in war zones. And just last year, researchers at Northwestern University created StatsMonkey. Now, this program isn't quite an upward standing machine that roams around querying nearby folks, but it can write stories, sports stories. It searches scores online and then writes an article with one of the narrative arcs installed in its system. Chris Malcolm works for a TV network specializing in college sports. He thinks StatsMonkey generates some pretty darn good content. He even publishes that material on his network's website. Here is a clip of Chris speaking about that to France 24 News.
That's all information that you would find in a game story that any human being would write. This came faster, and it came cleaner, and it came much more effectively.
I wanted to find out more, so I called Nick Allen. Nick started working on StatsMonkey as a journalism graduate student at Northwestern, and he told me that robots and programs like StatsMonkey do a lot more good than bad in the world of journalism. And he said, here's another reason why.
I think what's exciting about it is it really allows you to write a lot of stories that wouldn't other guys get written. So that, you know, that means covering teams that wouldn't get covered or tailoring stories to audiences.
Nick actually uses StatsMonkey to cover minor league baseball. Maybe only 100 people will read an article it writes, but it's there for those 100 people. Ira Basin knows all about tailoring content for audiences. He teaches journalism at Ryerson University and has recently been doing some research on a system that determines how to write news content. We're not talking robot writers. No, this is more like an online news algorithm.
Demand Media actually has more than 1 million articles on the web right now, and by the time today is over, there'll be another 5,000 articles written. This is a company that's developed an algorithm about what articles should be written and how they should be written.
When it comes down to it, robo-journalists, StatsMonkey, and Demand Media, they all do the same thing. They turn the process of writing and producing news content into an exact science.
The replacement of human judgment by algorithmic judgment is actually something that is kind of a bad thing. It's you know, disturbing.
But that's not how Nick sees it.
It's really not the replacement of human judgment. I mean, algorithmic judgment is just, that's human judgment applied sort of at scale. People are writing these programs, so that's where the human judgment is. And that's not going away.
Human judgment might not be going away, but neither is algorithmic judgment. These robots, these systems, are here to stay. The same lab that created StatsMonkey also created News at 7 a few years ago, a virtual newscast. So to conclude this segment, I'm going to let the robots take over my job for a moment. Here's Migo and George with the last word.
Hello, and welcome to News at 7. I'm Migo.
And I am George.
In a nutshell, News at 7 is a system that automatically generates a virtual news show. It's kind of like magic, except that it's not magic at all.
Nope. It's computers.
And that's our show. Thanks to our reporter Joel Taylor and our producer Anna Delaney.
I'm your host, Julianne Hazelwood. Thanks for tuning in to Decoder, helping you make sense of the new world of media.